North Platte session of the Nebraska Court of Appeals. We are very pleased to be here in greater Nebraska. We hope it was a little bit more convenient drive for most of you anyway to travel here as opposed to our primary courtroom in Lincoln. My name is Frankie Moore and I actually am from North Platte, so this is the one time a year I get to stay home. To my right is Judge Mike Pirtle from Omaha, and to my left, Judge Rico Bishop from Lincoln. Before we get started today, I promised Mr. Van Kampen of the Telegraph that he could take our photograph. So we're going to let him do that, and then he can be on his way.
Thank you, Judge. I'll take about four.
Okay.
Smile. Everybody's smiling.
Okay, we're in good shape. Just a couple more. Thank you
Good.
Very much.
Thank you so much. So we have six cases on our call today, and tomorrow we have four. I will advise tomorrow there will just be two judges here. I unfortunately will be out of town for a family funeral, but I will participate on the cases tomorrow by reviewing the record and the written briefs by the lawyers or the attorney or the parties. And then these proceedings are being audio recorded. I'll review that. And those audio recordings will be available on the Nebraska Supreme Court website in a couple of days, probably after they're uploaded. So with that, we will get started. Our first case of the day is State versus Johnson.
Can I reserve 2 minutes, please? Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, honorable justices, my name is Brandon Brinegar, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. Johnson. I'm with the Buffalo County Public Defender's Office. As you may have noticed from reviewing the record, I did not try this case. I did not brief this case, so I'm coming at this as a fresh pair of eyes. Looking at the brief prepared by Mr. Stewart, I've had to review the record myself, go over the evidence presented, and try and see how that fits with the argument that has been advanced on behalf of this appeal. And so in that sense, I'm getting a sense of what it's like for you guys every time you look at one of these. And the argument that is made on behalf of Mr. Johnson is that the state did not meet its burden with regard to the charge that he circumvented or tampered with the ignition interlock device. And I reviewed the transcript and the bill of exceptions and the video that was offered into evidence, and I would argue to you that is exactly correct. There was not evidence given to meet all of the elements of the crime, and very recently in State versus Mann, 302 Nebraska 804, it was reiterated that the Due Process Clause requires that the state prove every element of an offense beyond reasonable doubt and may not shift the burden of proof regarding any of those elements onto the defendant by presuming the proof of, or presuming one element upon proof of the others.
What element was not proved here?
That the interlock device itself was either tampered with or circumvented. I think the state clearly proved that there was one in his car, that he had been ordered to have an interlock device, and that he was intoxicated beyond the .02 per liter that of blood that the device would allow his car to activate with. And so that single element, that he did something or somehow circumvented the interlock device, there's no evidence of.
Can an element be proven by circumstantial evidence?
In certain cases, I imagine it could, but I don't think it can here, because the element we're talking about is actually a couple of different elements. There are choices. Did he circumvent or did he tamper with in some way? And I don't know how Mr. Johnson could have presented a defense without knowing what the state's theory of the case was. All the evidence that they offered was that the interlock device was there, that he was driving his car, that he was ordered to have one.
The officer also testified, though, didn't he, that interlock devices are designed so that the car will not start if a person blows in with alcohol on his or her breath, and it won't continue operating under that kind of circumstance as well.
Correct.
Isn't there an inference perhaps to be made that something must have happened to allow Mr. Johnson to operate this vehicle when he had alcohol in his system?
I think there's that inference, but what is the state inferring happened? Are they inferring that he somehow tampered with the device and disabled it, or that he found some other way to circumvent it, like by having another individual who didn't have that level of alcohol blow into it? Or is there the potential that the device somehow failed on its own? Technology fails all the time. Perhaps that could have happened. The state offered no evidence as to what could have or could not have happened to that device, and so left the defense guessing as to exactly what is it they're contending happened here that allowed him to drive with that interlock in his car. I think that if they had presented evidence that they had examined the device and it was in working order, then the inference could be that he'd somehow circumvented it. And so then I think you could infer all other options being ruled out, that maybe that's what he did. Or perhaps that if it had been testified to that the device had been examined and it was not in working order, that it had been disconnected somehow or was disabled, then we know it wasn't circumvented. Apparently the inference is the defendant disabled or damaged the device somehow.
A relatively new statute that has not been examined in appellate case law in Nebraska?
I believe that is the case. Most of the case law I looked at did not address this particular.
I noticed the trial court stated that Johnson admitted to the officer that he had turned off the device.
Well,
is there any evidence to support that statement?
Because I'm kind of sitting in your seat and I'm looking back to see where these rulings came from, I did look in the judge's order and noticed that he, in reviewing or in putting forth his opinion, said that the officer asked, how were you able to drive the vehicle when you're clearly been drinking? And in the judge's order on, unfortunately the page is not numbered, but he says that Officer Lobig asked if he had disabled the device, and the defendant advised that he had. I reviewed the video that the judge was referring to, because there were a couple of small sections of in-car video that were placed into evidence, and that never happens. The defendant is in the back of the car, and that question is asked by Officer Lobig. He says, how is it you were able to operate your vehicle with an interlock device, and you've obviously been drinking? And the defendant starts answering him, well, first you blow in it, and then after 5 minutes you have to blow in it again. And Officer Lobig says, I know how it works. And then he turns around and starts talking to the officer who's come up to the window to ask him about doing the preliminary breath test for him. There's never an answer, yes, I disabled it, given anywhere on that video. So there's not evidence on the video to support that statement in the judge's order. And if you look at the record of Officer Lobig's testimony, when asked, did you ask the defendant if he had disabled the device, or did you get some kind of statement from him that he disabled the device, Officer Lobig on the stand says, no, I didn't. So he knows he didn't get any statement from the defendant that admits to circumventing, tampering with, et cetera, the device. So what it is that's been done to this device, whether it's mechanical failures, circumvention, tampering, that's all up in the air. We're left to guess.
So even if they had examined the ignition interlock device and found it to be operational, couldn't a jury, by circumstantial, he had 0.18 alcohol blood content, correct?
Yes.
In his testing immediately after driving, he was observed swerving, going over a curb, right?
Yes.
And so couldn't they circumstantially conclude that he had to have done something to circumvent the proper use of that ignition interlock device? If he was driving drunk, was getting around the use of that device, if it was working.
If they had examined it and found that it was in working order, and all those other factors, then yes, I think they could infer all other possibilities have been accounted for. That's the one that's left. That if the device hasn't been tampered with, if it's in working order, then he must have done something to circumvent it somehow.
And if they'd have examined it and it wasn't working, they could have also concluded he did something to the device. So it's kind of either way, isn't
right.
it, that circumstantially a jury could conclude.
But they did neither.
What do you mean they did neither?
They found him guilty. They presented no evidence that it was either tampered with or that it was in perfectly good working order. And so how is the defendant supposed to know what theory of the case he's supposed to present?
Because as we just discussed, does it matter if it was working or not working if the evidence is that he was driving with that device in his car?
His
blood alcohol content was 0.18.
I think it does matter because it impermissibly shifts the burden to him to prove himself innocent with regard to that section of the statute. The state has offered no proof that he was guilty.
Circumstantial evidence.
But it's shifted the burden to him to say, no, I did neither of those things. Mm-hmm.
Isn't circumstantial evidence just as strong as regular evidence? Isn't that what the case law says?
I think in some cases it can be. I don't know that it is here because there are still too many possibilities left open. Circumstantial evidence, you know, should, if it's strong enough, lead us to an irrevocable conclusion. You know, this must have happened, and I don't think the evidence offered by the state has gotten us to that point.
Sorry about the buzz.
That's all right.
But that is your red light. And
yes, it is.
We've taken you over into your rebuttal time.
That's fine.
Our on-the-road red light's a little harsher than the one in our main courtroom.
I think we have new technology that we're trying out for the first time today. So.
Hey, technology fails.
Well, there you go. You don't need a rebuttal. Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, I'm Erin Tangeman, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Nebraska.
Can I clarify something real quick? I didn't want to take him much further over. This was a bench trial, was it not?
Yes, it was.
So does that make a difference here when we're weighing the evidence and the sufficiency of the evidence, or is it the same either way?
I think it's the same either way. We're just looking at a rational trier of fact, and for this court's purposes, I don't think it matters if it was a bench trial or a jury trial. I think whether or not it was a bench trial would matter if there was some inadmissible evidence or something
of
that regard.
Conflicting evidence of some kind.
Yes, but I don't think we have any of those issues here.
Right.
I think we're dealing with a straight sufficiency.
Okay.
Well, speaking of the bench trial, can we first talk about the trial judge's findings that Mr. Johnson admitted to the officer that he had turned off the interlock device?
Yes, I would agree that that's correct. I do think when you watch the video, and unfortunately, I did watch the video, but it was 6 or 7 months ago, and my notes were not as good as I had hoped they were when I pulled out the file earlier this week. But my recollection is that the question was asked, and there may have been some answers from the defendant. I don't know that it was really clear. The other thing I'm not certain of is if that portion of the video was entered into evidence at trial. My recollection of the Bill of Exceptions is that the prosecutor didn't enter the exhibit as a whole, but he went segment of certain pieces that he wanted, the traffic stop itself, I believe the various field sobriety tests, potentially when he was arrested. So I'm not even certain, and like I said, I apologize that my notes were not great. I haven't seen the video for several months, but I would agree, I don't think that is an accurate statement of the evidence.
So if the trial court relied upon that admission in its finding of guilt, do we have a problem here?
I don't think I mean, obviously, this court can't rely on that finding because it is clearly erroneous. And so I think we just go to back to the general standard of review, and whether any rational trier of fact could have found in the light most favorable to the state that this evidence was sufficient to support the conviction. And so we have to look at the other evidence that was presented. And that evidence presented by the prosecutor was the officer's testimony, basically general testimony about ignition interlock devices in general, how they work, that the car will not start unless someone blows into the device, and that as the person is driving the car, apparently, periodically, you will have to blow into it to continue. So that evidence, along with evidence that the defendant was drunk and that ignition interlock device was in his vehicle, that is circumstantial evidence that he somehow tampered or circumvented the device in order to drive the vehicle.
What about the argument of the appellant that perhaps that would be a better position had there been testimony that the device was properly working by the officer?
Well, I think as Judge Bishop says, I don't know the fact that it was, if the officer would have looked at it and it was not working necessarily means that the defendant didn't tamper with it either. I think it's hard in this case. I don't personally know a lot about ignition interlock devices, and I'll admit that the evidence presented by the prosecutors, you know, is very small. I do believe the officers looked at the device, but we don't have a lot of testimony of what they thought, if it looked like it had been physically tampered with. I think if it looked like it was in working order, that could also mean he circumvented it in some way, and I don't know that we would ever know one way or the other, just based on a view of the device itself, unless it was something obvious where they somehow, you know, were able to disconnect it or something of that nature.
Was there any evidence as to how often an individual has to blow into the device in order to continue driving?
No.
No.
No specific evidence.
And then about the argument that the state should be required to prove what its theory is, whether it's tampered with or circumvented.
I don't know that the state is limited to that. I think, you know, the state took a broad and he either tampered or circumvented, and here's our circumstantial evidence that the defendant did that. I don't know that we are limited one way or the other. The evidence is what it is in this case. The state's position is that it's circumstantial evidence. It's a reasonable inference that he was driving the vehicle because he somehow interfered, tampered, whatever you want to call it, with the device. And regarding, you know, whether the device itself was defective and he didn't do anything but it just started working, I mean, the state doesn't have to disprove any possible inference. Under the sufficiency standard of review, the question, as this court is well aware, any rational trier of fact could have found the elements beyond a reasonable doubt. I do not have anything further unless this court would have additional questions for me.
So if somebody got in the car and hadn't consumed any alcohol and blew in the device, so the car started,
mm-hmm.
and then they drank,
mm-hmm.
that's why I was curious about how often do you have to test, because arguably if that happened, he didn't tamper or circumvent initially.
Initially, right.
But since the blood alcohol testing was done immediately after he was driving, then circumstantially a jury, or in this case the judge, could conclude that he had to have somehow circumvented.
Right.
Right.
I would agree.
Yeah.
And wasn't the blood alcohol test, it was quite excessive here,
0.18,
wasn't it?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So if there had been delays, well, no, never mind.
Yeah.
Not looking at
case.
All the possibilities. Yeah.
No.
Okay. Thank you.
We ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you. The appellant's out of time. So thank you both, counsel. Your case is submitted and you are excused.